Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Christian Corley. He's James McClane. Welcome. This week we're turning our attention to the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I think we're mainly going to talk about Thor Ragnarok, although I dare say some of the other recent movies may rear their heads.
Probably.
I was reading an article about Thor Ragnarok. I think it was Thor Ragnarok. It might be in the next Avengers movie. I'm not sure. But it said it was like movie number 17 or something.
Could be, I guess.
Because you've got the Captain America ones. You've got the existing Avengers, what, three? Yeah, you've got Iron Man, is that three?
Four. Three.
Thors now. You've got two Guardians of the Galaxies.
Yeah.
Where does that take us to?
I wasn't counting. But it's about 10, isn't it?
And then you've got Spider-Man and Ant-Man.
Yeah. You've got the Hulks.
Of course, the Hulk, yeah.
I think you only count two of those. So you've got... No, one of those, sorry. You only count the Ed Norton one.
Right, okay.
So you probably got... And then,
It's insane if you think about it like that, isn't it? It's like, 20 years ago, you couldn't get a superhero movie for love nor money.
It's a long way since the days of Batman, isn't it? Tim Burton's era.
Yeah. And they were sort of well-regarded movies. I haven't watched either of those for a long time, so I couldn't go back. But I'm a little bit reluctant to go back and see how well they stand up, although... they were better. I cannot see them having dated as badly as the later movies, which I have seen, the Schumacher movies, have seen more recently.
I still have on my shelf, I have the original, which I still love, and it's my favourite of the Batman movies. I think it's very shrewdly anachronistic, so it doesn't really date, because it doesn't really have a time to it. I mean, you can feel back end of 80s, 90s to it, but generally speaking, I think it ages really well. What we have now is as close to comic book as you can get, which is kind of amusing, really. This sort of crossovering, mixture of tones and styles, a lot of confidence with the source material with Marvel,
mm-hmm.
and shrewd pickings of choices of characters, castings, and being fairly risky as well. I mean, DC's done, as I say, DC did Wonder Woman, which was really good. Well, yeah, it was pretty good. I enjoyed it. And it really was a great movie for women as well, which was great.
Now, you see, I have a bit of a problem about going to watch Wonder Woman. Okay, I've got absolutely no problem with Wonder Woman. I always enjoyed Wonder Woman as a child. Well, when movies come along dressed in politics, I don't want to watch them. I'm immediately turned off. And I don't think I'm alone in this.
I don't think it's dressed in politics per se. I mean, politics exists around...
Oh, well, perhaps not. Well, it is presented perhaps as part of the PR as, being something...
I think that's as much as the media is.
Yeah, I agree. But
it makes a story.
But it puts me off wanting to watch it. I don't want to watch Black Panther. I love Black Panther in the... was it the Avengers movie he was in, or was it the Iron Man movie? I forget. Or was it the Captain America movie? Whichever one it was, I thought he was great. And I've read Black Panther many, many, many years ago. Thought it was good. I want to see the movie, but it's just putting me off going to watch it. I just want to watch a movie. I don't want to watch an agenda. And whether the agenda's in there or not, it's being presented as if there is an agenda in there.
But there is an agenda so far as there has been... an agenda which has assumed or has ignored certain demographics, and mm-hmm. that has been an agenda. There's no doubt about it. Not necessarily out of any racism, but just simply because there's been this assumption that what sells best is to white middle class 16 to 22-year-olds or whatever. And that has been largely the point, largely the place. And one of the actors in Black Panther, I forgot his name, the gentleman who was in Get Out, he was sort of saying how it was amazing for him, because when he grew up as a kid, you know, there was just no one there on the screen that represented him as a hero. You know, there was people that he couldn't sort of look on the screen and identify visually as him, as representing him in the way that perhaps, you know, we can, in the sense of being white males. White males are all out there as great heroic protagonists.
I'm going to hold off from saying he didn't go to see Blade then.
Well, Blade was the one who I think he was talking about, was the only, I'm trying to remember, it was, I think it might have been Blade, has been one of the only ones that he looked at and went, you know, wow, that is made for me.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it wasn't necessarily made for him, it was one that he could identify, but that was about it. And if you think about how many heroes that we can identify with, if we're talking about physical identification of being white males, you can understand why this is quite a game changer and political, not in the sense that it has to try and be political, but in the sense that it defies the rules which have been established that you make for white males, essentially. And I think that was the same with Wonder Woman, and there was a talk slightly after Wonder Woman, I don't know how true it was, but there would be murmurings that maybe they need to do another sequel, which would be Wonder Man, which was sort of on this logic that if Wonder Woman had done really so well, imagine how good Wonder Man would do if it was a white male. Totally misunderstanding why Wonder Woman sort of worked in its own way. So I know what you mean. There is a sort of political thing which is woven around it, which gets frustrating. But it's sort of almost like the political thing is the fact that it shouldn't be there by the sort of consensus of media politics, and yet because it's there, it becomes an issue, even though it shouldn't be. And from what I hear, I mean, as you say, I mean, Black Panther was good in the Civil War. This is meant to be a great movie.
Yeah.
And again, what I was going to say is I kind of like the way that Marvel has been taking these risks. And while Wonder Woman, to a degree, was a slight, well, it wasn't a risk, but it was doing something that perhaps Marvel hadn't done yet, because they hadn't done the female particularly, and done, you know, Black Widow sits in the Avengers, but nothing particularly great. The film itself was very much a borrowing of the Captain America, sort of looking back, placing into a historical war, and taking it out of the sort of standard continuity, which had worked really well for Captain America, which was a surprise, and it was kind of borrowed again. So I kind of like Marvel because it does try and do these sort of risk things. And from what I hear, you know, as I say, it doesn't feel like it's particularly playing a racial card. It's doing sort of like what Netflix has been doing with female leads. There's so many female leads on Netflix, and it feels really good. I feel I watch Netflix, there's a nice mixture of genders being played in key roles, and they're normally played pretty well, guys and girls. And
yeah.
I suddenly realized how little of that we had in broadcast television. Mm. So I think as long as the stuff's good, I think it's nice to see, you know, a lot of people being represented out there. And yes, I mean, I never thought Wonder Woman was actually particularly, didn't ever feel that. People said, oh, you know, it's a film that pioneers women and, you know, pushes women forward and it's women agendered. But when I watched it, I thought, actually, this isn't horrendously different to many other films I've seen with a woman in a leading role. Not many of them, obviously, but it didn't blow me away in that sort of sense. So I'll be interested to see how Black Panther sort of feels. You know, does it feel like it's, I don't know, that it's pushing some sort of point about how we look at race, or whether it's just a film which is set in a particular country which naturally has a certain race and thus is part of the film's makeup. I don't know. But, yeah. So what were we here to talk about?
Well, we're here to talk about Thor Ragnarok, mainly.
Oh, yeah.
Well, do you know what? I'm going to go into this. I've got a couple of things I want to say about this. Firstly, oh, God, it pains me to say this. It's not pain. It's just kind of, I'm glad that it is. But at the same time, it's a bit, well, basically, this is a film I have enjoyed more than anything that I've seen in a long time. Which, it's, you know, there's all these movies, it's kind of what I was alluding to at the beginning with, you know, this series of like 17 odd movies or whatever. And you're looking at that portion of what's going on. Then you look across the road at Star Wars, which can barely put four movies together without losing 13 directors. And the last one is enjoyable, but, you know, coming out the same year as Thor Ragnarok, if I had the choice between two movies I would go and watch again, I'll be watching Thor Ragnarok.
Oh, yeah.
It's such an enjoyable film. Do you know what? I was thinking after I'd watched it, it felt like Flash Gordon.
Well, in many ways. When the trailer came out, I don't know if you watched the trailer, when that came out, it felt very 80s and the whole typography. Yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, Star Wars is suffering under the burden of its expectations. That it's now such a massive beast. I just don't know if they really know where to go with it. And I must admit, I love the Solo trailer. I never thought I would have any interest in that film, but it got me going. But it is, it looks like, anyway, a redo of Rogue One. So Rogue One's worked well, so let's do the same thing with Smugglers. That's how it feels to me. So Star Wars is still a little uncertain where it's going and finding its voice, maybe. But yeah, you're right. Well, no, I suppose, no, I think Marvel hasn't found its voice. I think it had, and then it's gone on a slightly different tangent, which I think we've said in a podcast before. I just did in one with John Muir. I can't remember. I say these things a lot. But Marvel sort of has evolved again in a kind of funny way where DC hasn't. DC's sort of playing catch-up with its Justice League and its sort of multi-universe. And as soon as it starts trying to put an arc into a place, Marvel suddenly seems to twig that what people want now at the moment is just feel-good movies. So they don't particularly want an arc, and I think that's what you get with Infinity War. You get this sort of slight, sort of meandered, not that interested buzz. People are like, because they just want, at the moment, they just want to be entertained. They don't want story arcs. They don't want big epic.
Well, you've got Netflix for story arcs, haven't you?
Well, yeah, maybe that as well. I just don't think they care. Like, at the moment, I think what people like. I mean, I watched Guardians of the Galaxy 2 earlier in the year, and I loved that, like Thor. I went to the cinema, and that was a midnight screening, and just enjoyed myself. There was no depth to it. There was no massively clever plotting to it. But in both cases, it was just an enjoyable movie. And I think I said this to John the other day. Sometimes you just want to go out and you just... The world is so crazy in not a good way at the moment. It's just nice to just go and lose yourself. And I think Marvel's twigged to that. And maybe its story arc thing is obviously still running because it's been a master plan for the last decade or so. So they're still trapped in that. But they're sort of doing these things around it, which are a little more, I think, what people are after. Something which is standalone, fun, and, you know, engaging on that level. I mean, people laughed in Thor.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, how many English people, when you go to the cinema, I've said this before, British people don't tend to react much to cinema in the way that Americans do. You know, test screenings in America are so much easier than British, because British are actually quite reserved. They don't really laugh in a cinema unless they really feel the need to. They don't tend to clap or whoop. But Thor had people reacting because they were enjoying it.
I'm not sure. Well, whooping's a very kind of American thing, isn't it? It could be considered to be, you know, extraneous to everyday life. There really isn't any need for it.
No.
Clapping and cheering, yeah, I'll go with that. Whistling. I think it depends what you're going to see, though, and maybe where you are as well. I've seen, what have I seen at the pictures? It was a comedy that people laughed through, with Nil and I. Although, then again, I don't think there was many people in the screening who hadn't seen it.
Well, I was going to say that. I went to see Jumanji 2.
Right.
And people had the same reaction to that. People were laughing throughout it. And I've not really seen this much in cinemas for a long time. But it's either a generational thing where people are more relaxed and it's now more culturally accepted to sort of be more comfortable in the cinema, or it's just that these films are actually quite good, they're quite smart. They maybe not, as I say, you know, the form might not be anything mind-blowing, but the actual moment-by-moment is actually enjoyable and eliciting a good response. And yeah, I just came out and thought, this is the best thing I've seen in ages, because I just enjoyed it all the way through. It made me laugh. There was good action. The dialogue was, you know, was allegedly a lot of it was improvised, and that sort of came through. It felt very relaxed, confident, and the tone and the aesthetic was all confident as well. So you felt comfortable all the way through. That there was nothing there that was problematic. It was great. And yeah, I think after that, then you know, the Infinity War trailer comes out, and everyone's like, oh. more explosions and pseudo or faux tension amongst super beings.
Mm. I think Thor as well. I think you'd go into seeing that. If you'd seen the previous Thor movies, you might not be expecting Thor Ragnarok to be what it was. Because he was a bit po-faced, wasn't he?
He was tedious.
Yeah.
Chris Hemsworth, is it? I got that impression from his interviews that he was feeling the same. He was bored with Thor. And that was a large motivation in them sort of trying to play up and find a new tone for him. And you're right. I found Thor, I saw it on the plane, it was tedious. I said I'd never see another Thor film again. I watched the second film just because I was going to see the third one. So I got bored again and half watched it. He's a tedious character. He was the worst one of the lot. And I suppose they found a little bit of the humour in the Avengers films with him. There was a tiny bit there, and that seemed to sort of give them the right ideas of where, you know, that Chris could pull this off. But it's not just Chris. I mean, they've got a great cast in there. I mean, Jeff Goldblum's probably the best thing in the film.
He's fantastic. He's going to be in the new Jurassic World movie, isn't he? And the first thing you think of when Jeff Goldblum, you think, where the hell's he been for the last 20 years?
He was in the Independent, not that I've seen it, the Independence Day sequel as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, prior to that, he has had a quiet few years. And he's not doing anything different to what he was doing 20 years ago, but he's got that kind of sinister charm going on, hasn't he? He's always had, he's got like dangerous edge to every line that he says.
I've always preferred him in the comedies when he does. I think his comedy timing is really good.
Yes, it is. Yeah, yeah. He's also similar to Walken as well, I think, in that you never quite know how he's going to pronounce the next word.
Yeah, that's true.
Or emphasize the next word.
Yeah, yeah. And that's why it worked, I think, in Thor. Yeah. The way his delivery, as much as from what I could feel, was that there was a lot of improv there from him as well. It just made me laugh throughout. And all the other staple characters were good. You know, Loki was a lot of fun in that.
Yeah.
I think they very wisely found a lot of fun between him and Thor, keeping them closely bound together. You know, the use of the Hulk and Ruffalo was really effective as well. It was just a good film throughout. There wasn't really anything that was wrong with it. I just kind of hope that in the sort of deluge of films you have at the moment, that it does sort of maintain that as a, because, I mean, it's very much like Flash Gordon in a lot of ways. Obviously, a far tidier, more confident, and more focused thing than Flash Gordon was. But Flash Gordon sort of stood out because there was nothing really else like it at the time.
Yeah.
You know, even the Star Wars stuff was nothing like it. The Sword and Sorcery stuff was nothing like it. So it sort of has that memorable moment. In the same way that sort of Blade Runner had as well, because there was nothing quite like that. With Thor, you know, when you've got Guardians of the Galaxy, and is it just going to end up just being a sort of enjoyed but forgotten sequel, or will it carry a cult level to it? I don't know.
Difficult to say, isn't it?
I thought it was brave as well. Again, they do things in their movies which I don't think DC has really found its voice yet, or found the confidence in the material, I think, is what it lacks. I mean, in the beginning of that Thor movie, they destroy the hammer, which is, you know, a particularly bold move, I think, for a character who's most exciting thing about him tends to be the hammer.
The hammer, yeah. I mean, kids love the hammer. It's a major marketing tool.
Absolutely. So to destroy that in the first 20 minutes, presuming people listening to this have actually seen the film, you idiots, is incredible. I thought that was an incredibly bold move. And it just shows the confidence in the film and, it can hold up without the gimmick.
Yeah, and also it's like it puts you, it wrong foots you, doesn't it? Because then you think you know what's going to happen with this movie, and then all of a sudden you've got no idea.
Yeah.
The first thing you're going to think is he going to go and find a hammer?
Yes.
What is he going to do without the hammer? He needs a new hammer. And, you know, it's never mentioned again until a vision with Odin. And that's it.
Yeah, absolutely. And, yeah, it never returns, which is really surprising. So, and to me, that shows confidence in material. That shows you know what you're doing, and that's something I don't think DC has got. I don't think that the Lucas Star Wars franchise has got at the moment. they know what they're doing, or they I almost feels like that they trust in their creatorship to let them go and do what they need to do, because the director of this film, was his fingerprints were all over it, and so it feels like, you know, the studios just sort of let them do what they wanted to do. You don't, I mean, I think to some degree, I mean, as much as people scream and fury at Kathleen Kennedy, I know she had involvement in The Last Jedi. You know, their tact is slightly different, where there is a sort of a lot, there's no overall game plan, and, you know, they're letting people pretty much create movie per movie, which is an interesting idea, but you get a massive, it doesn't feel confident in the same way.
I think killing the expanded universe was a mistake. Because they've put a Mexican border wall along it. You know, they could be going back and using that stuff and repurposing that stuff.
They are letting refugees through.
Yes, they are.
Rebels has had Thrawn reappear. There are bits and
there's a new Thrawn novel as well.
I mean, it's a bit Time War-ish if we're going to sort of refer to the other podcast.
Yeah. No.
Our less exciting clones who run that podcast. they do think they are special and very, very boring people. We here could still, yeah, it is like that thing where you have the Time War, which sort of limits delimits where you want to go.
Yeah.
And you can then poach where you need to, which I think is great.
Mm-hmm. I think you've got to do it the right way, though, haven't you?
Yeah.
And I don't think Star Wars is doing it the right way. I think Star Wars is trying too hard to create new stuff. And then, you know, you look back over and see what Marvel Comics are doing, or the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and they're just digging into their 50-plus years of amazing and some, let's be honest, terrible comics, pulling out gems and giving us stuff like Guardians of the Galaxy and Thor Ragnarok.
But I suppose the problem is that Star Wars doesn't, while it has a plethora of a franchise of different stuff, there's not that much really there. You have three initial films, six if you count the prequels. Yes, there are stuff in the expanded universe and the like, but I don't get the impression it has that sort of diversity. I mean, to be fair to Marvel, I mean, it's got not just all those years of comics, but all those different franchises of comics. It's got so much to pick from.
Yeah.
And I suppose Star Wars doesn't really have that amount of material, because whenever they do extra stuff, it tends to have one of the main cast in there somewhere or another. There's very little which stands totally alone. So I think that causes them a problem. And like I say, there's a lot of expectations of what it should be, which, to be fair, you know, superhero movies originally had as well. It took superhero movies a while to find their footing. And as I say, DC still feel like they're not quite finding their voice, which is incredible, really. And I think that's because they picked wrong people to create. Well, they're rushing. You know,
I don't know what they're doing wrong, because if you flip on the TV and watch the Marvel cartoons versus the DC cartoons.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's the other way around.
Yeah, DC ones have always been far more inventive and memorable. But yeah, for me, the mistakes DC made was it's trying to rush to get up to where Marvel is. So as you say, while Marvel's had 17, 18 films, they had, you know, a couple of, they had this new franchise pretty much had what? A Superman film, a Batman Superman film, Wonder Woman film, and then it's tried to sort of create its team rather than, you know, this gradual build-up that Marvel had. So it's rushed. I'm not sure they managed to find the right tone for Superman. I think that was their big mistake. So they've got no real contrast there, which I think you need. Superman and Batman sit too easily in the same universe, where I think the point of DC should have been that contrast there, that tone, in the same way that, you know, Spider-Man. And I think that's where I think Marvel has always been quite good, because I think that was the big changer for me, is when they did that original Spider-Man movie, and I thought with Tobey Maguire, and you think, okay, you can actually do someone in a red and blue suit in daytime, going through, you know, spinning his webs through New York, and it can look believable. We're on a game changer here, because before that, everyone's suits were always very latex. It was very stiff. Everything had to be done at night. You know, the Batman films, Dark Man, everything was all dark and gloomy.
Yeah.
And then suddenly Spider-Man said, yeah, we can do this in the day. So why they didn't try and do that same thing with Superman, I have no idea. That, to me, was crazy. You know, and make him stand for what he stand for in the comics. Then you've got a brilliant contrast to Batman.
Yeah, and Gotham is not Metropolis, is it? They're two completely different alien to each other places. And that's why it works for each character.
Yeah. So I think if they'd established Superman in something which felt more, instead of trying to make him like, how would Superman be in this world? Which is a very, it feels to me like a very spineless way of saying, we feel the original source material is outdated or just won't translate. So how do we translate it to cultural things which people can understand? Yeah, you could say that's a sort of fairly interesting Elseworld, you know, extended universe, alternate universe thing, but you should have tried to bring Superman and show that you can do that character and make it funny and exciting and like Thor. Because I think what Thor did is what they should have done with Superman. That's the sort of thing they could have done, something fun, they could have had a little bit of fun with him, made him a little more comical, but made him true to who he was and bright and vivid. Metropolis should have been bright and vivid. And then you've got, as you say, you've got your Gotham, which is dark, gloomy, and menacing. And then when you come to the Justice League thing, you've got this sort of almost Art Deco-y sort of Wonder Woman sort of style you could have. You'd have your, well, I suppose people say it's the Batman style, you know, the classics of Wonder Woman, the vibrance. But, you know, it would all start to fit together better, and they just didn't do that. So, yeah, so they're now busy trying to create their arcs. Well, it seems to me with Ant-Man, Guardians of the Galaxy, Thor, Black Panther, Spider-Man Homecoming, Marvel has realised that we need to go past that and do fun stuff.
Yeah. I mean, there is obviously linking themes and storylines between the movies, isn't there? But they're not going heavy on them.
No, absolutely. And so, the bits with Doctor Strange, which is another Marvel movie.
Of course, yes.
Which was a lot of fun as well.
I haven't seen that yet.
Yeah, it is fun. It's not mind-blowing. But, again, like Ant-Man, and it's just enjoyable.
Yeah, Ant-Man I liked a lot. And Deadpool as well.
Yes, Deadpool again, if we go Marvel side. Deadpool was a lot of fun.
Last year we had Thor Ragnarok and Guardians of the Galaxy 2 in 2017. There's also another movie, which isn't a Marvel movie. Obviously, because I mentioned this relationship with Flash Gordon. Last year, Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets was released.
Yes.
Have you seen it?
I saw it, actually, 2 weeks ago.
Right. Now, how does that sit as a sort of space opera in the... I mean, it's directed by Luc Besson, so obviously you've got a potential comparison with The Fifth Element.
And links to The Fifth Element in there as well.
Oh, right, okay.
Have you seen it?
I haven't seen it yet. No, it's on my watch list.
Okay, it's a beautiful movie, right. Like The Fifth Element. It is an absolutely stunning little movie to watch. It's heinous.
Because it's based on a comic strip, isn't it?
It is. It's based on a French comic strip back from the 60s. Its heinous mistake is that its main casting is terrible. Right. And the scripting for those characters is terrible. And so, and it's too long.
Okay.
But it looks beautiful. It's a really beautiful feel. I think there's some bits of it which are quite true to the comics. Some of it isn't. The two main characters, which, you know, I don't want to say without giving anything away. They have a sort of dynamic, which to me, as an audience member, didn't make sense. They open up the male and female, Valerian and his count and his colleague are both agents. There's this dynamic or sexual tension which is thrown in the first scene where she's sort of knocking him back, but he's all cocky and I'm sort of going to have you, and she's sort of like, I'm not going to be another notch on your scorecards of women that you've conquered. And then a few scenes later, he hasn't changed any way, and he's there saying, well, why didn't you marry me? And she's actually thinking about it. And you're thinking, I'm lost here. So, you know, are you together?
Isn't that just France? Isn't that just the French?
Well, it doesn't feel French in any way at all.
Okay.
It feels utterly Americanized. And I just think, I can't remember what the name of the actor is who plays him. I like him as an actor. He was in Homecoming as well.
Right. Yeah.
Spider-Man Homecoming, if we're going to throw a link in there. And he's a great actor, but he just isn't charming for a character who doesn't really progress in any way beyond his desire to bed this woman. From having failed to actually woo her, he goes on to the marriage idea, which you can guess the way it goes. So say it doesn't do anything inspiring with these two, but it makes them, she's good as an actress and as a character. She plays that quite well.
That's Cara Delevingne.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, Dane DeHaan, say good actor, but the role just makes you just not like him at all. He's a dick. And, you know, that's a longish movie. What does it say?
137 minutes, says it. 137 minutes. 220 nearly, isn't it? 12:20 nearly. Yeah.
It's a longish movie. Rihanna's interestingly deployed in there. Clive Owen is what you'd imagine Clive Owen to be. But it is very vibrant. It's very colourful. And you could almost imagine it fitting that sort of desire to keep, you know, to just escape from the madness, whatever political spectrum you're on. I'm sure you think the other side is mad, and I think we all feel that at the moment. So the escape to something like this is, you know, desirable. But
I think they're all mad. But I just want to reassure our listeners out there that the world isn't as bad as the press makes out it is. We live in a time where we have amazing technology, there is lower poverty than there's ever been in other times of human history. We can keep going like this. Do not be pushed back by the negative media.
Well, I would say things are pretty bad, because where we thought we were at, we are nowhere near. And I think the media has revealed, even if you just look through comments rather than actual articles, that people are really not anymore sort of broadly, there isn't the progression I think we kind of, well, people like me kind of hoped we'd have seen in people than there actually is. And, you know, just like I say, you know, you can see that visibly. Now, it doesn't mean that now is far worse than it ever has been. I think things now are far crazier than they ever have been. And I think that has changed. And I think a lot of that is to do with the media again.
Mm.
And, as we've said before, I think we've said many times before, you have such a deluge of information that it just overloads to a point where people can get away with so much more visibly, because the next wave of news will actually saturate and overshadow, and it will disperse the threat. So the stuff that's happening now, which 30 years ago, I don't think people would have got away with if it being exposed. From various political allegiances, actors, everything, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But because there's so much, the stuff doesn't stick. And so I think that's why I think things feels crazy now. I think back to the era, you know, 2004, when people were shouting at, you know, screaming rightly and wrongly at Tony Blair, George Bush and everything like that. And everything seemed a bit crazy, but it seemed, even then, it seemed, I don't know, believable. Now everything just seems, because I just think there's just news story after news story after news story. It's just people get away with more. There's more to see. And
this is why people are turning the news off.
Basically. But this is why it goes back to my point, though, if we take your point as well, Christian, that things aren't necessarily as bad, and we don't focus on, you know, the good things are happening as well. It's just that there is so much information overload out there that sometimes sitting in a theater with a big screen, pumping out something which is fun, distracting, mm-hmm. without overly complicated, it's just is becoming more and more pleasurable. And I think we do go through periods in our history. I mean, you can sort of look at the Star Wars phenomenon and sort of say whether that was just by pure coincidence or not. But, you know, after the 70s, as we've said before, and Gareth loves to remind us as well, was such a period of, you know, there's a lot of depression, there's a lot of political issues, there's, you know, it was quite a mundane time, and suddenly you get this new Hollywood explosion of, you know, exciting, fun, adventurous escapism. You know, was that just coincidence, or was that what people needed? Did they need to escape? Why so Space 1999 and, you know, Survivors and the like sort of played on the sort of darkness, and we needed something to... Are we in that sort of era again where we're looking to cinema to raise our spirits?
Perhaps. Let's go back to Ragnarok, and I just want to go through the players. Because we've got Chris Hemsworth as Thor, obviously, but also his brother is in the film as well, playing Thor.
Yes, in the play.
Hiddleston as Loki. I still can't see Hiddleston as Bond, I'm afraid.
That's not confirmed, though. That was just something.
No. It's been a thing in the press for a long time, hasn't it? That he should be the next Bond. I just cannot see him as Bond at all. He's a perfectly good actor. I just don't think he has the right level of, for want of a better word, machismo. I just don't. He doesn't have that Bond threat, I think. I feel.
It'd be interesting. I'd have to see. I don't. He's never struck me. What was the other film he was in? The gothic horror one that was out a few years ago.
He's in Attack the Block, isn't he? Is he one of those British ones?
It wasn't that. And there was a film that he was in a few years.
Is he Warhorse as well?
That's cool.
Oh, it's High Rise, beg your pardon, not Attack the Block, it's High Rise, is it?
The one I think it was Crimson Peak.
Right.
Which was, you know, an interesting film. Yeah, it was Del Toro. But he was meant to be sort of a wooer to her in a sort of gothic romance. And I just never felt... I never felt his charm.
Right.
In that sort of sense, that sort of predatory sexual charm, which is, you know, horrid to say, sort of quite staple to the James Bond character, that you need to feel that person could naturally charm.
Yeah.
Quite literally the pants off, you know, as part of the genre, part of the franchise, sorry. And so, yeah, that would be my issue with him, is that I don't imagine him having that sort of, perhaps as you say, if that's a macho thing, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think it necessarily has to be, but I just never felt it with him.
Yeah.
I don't know, yeah.
Cate Blanchett as Hela, which I didn't recognise her for most of the movie.
Yeah, she was good.
She was excellent, yeah. Admittedly, she isn't in a lot of the movie, but no, she's very good. Idris Elba, of course, as Heimdall, he's been in all three. And a nice kind of different job for him in this one as well, rather than just standing still.
Yep.
Jeff Goldblum, as we've mentioned, is the Grand Master. And this part of the film, which is kind of the main body of the film, isn't it, set on Sakaar, is very 80s Marvel, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
You know, like the whole the alien landscape, so like abandoning Earth entirely, like a lot of things did in those days. It's and into the 90s as well. I'm not so familiar with Marvel these days, so I don't know if they still do it, that sort of thing. But it all felt very, very real. It's like you don't see much of it. You don't really know much about the people that live there, other than that they're from all over the place. You know, there's a lot of junk there. And yet it feels entirely real, which has got to be partially the storytelling, but also in the visual design of the place as well.
Yeah, the visual design was good, absolutely.
It's stunning, I think. It's awesome. It's really good. And I think as well, when you know, it's 2018 now. People have been making sci-fi movies and TV shows and everything else for years and years and years and years. So to be able to present something that looks visually different on screen, or at least memorable insofar as it is part of the movie's iconography, I think that's worth seeing the movie just for that.
Well, I think it's interesting again that we're going back out, and whether it's correct or not, but we seem to be retrospectively looking at the 80s as an era of very upbeat movies. And obviously Thor Ragnarok, like Guardians of the Galaxy, which through its little tape deck alone, and Stranger Things, which is obviously a darker part of the 80s, but there is something about the 80s which seems to bring us back into a period of fun films.
Yeah.
I'm not sure, as I say, whether that's entirely true.
Well, there's a big chunk of dark films from the 80s, which perhaps we'll be talking about sometime when we can get Gareth back on.
Yeah, absolutely. But there is something about the 80s that's vivid, that's exciting. We seem to be sort of going for soundtracks which sort of exist around the 70s and 80s, which are retro, but got a bit of an edge to them, so they're not quite as, perhaps, poppy as the 60s. It's a weird era that we seem to now be embracing as an era that we want to go to. And the odd thing is, as I think I might have said before, it's not even as like people like us who live through it. It seems to be, you know, people past 80s, 90s and onwards who seem to be interested in this love of the 80s, which Stranger Things has imbued, and Back to the Future.
Well,
you know, still sits on students.
It was a thing in, you know, back in the 80s and 90s, everyone was obsessed by the 60s.
There was, certainly by the 90s, there was a hippie 60s revival in the sort of first few years, wasn't there?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you could certainly see it on the music scene with things like Happy Mondays and Spiral Carpets in the UK.
Yeah.
That sort of feeling. But yeah, I mean, given that we're sort of talking 30 years back, so it'd be like sort of looking back at the 50s. It's a weird time. I think one of the things, I've been saying this a lot, and I think we've probably said this, we always keep saying that on these podcasts like our clones do. We've said this before, but the 80s, I still don't think we're seeing such a massive change in styles since sort of back end of the 90s. The last 20 years, styles haven't massively changed. Technology sort of defines the change.
Yeah.
But the styles haven't, so maybe the 90s and the 80s are becoming embraced because they are so clear, to some degree, clearly defined. I think 80s, both eras are, you've got to be careful, because certainly I would say there's a big difference between early 80s and late 80s in terms of certain styles.
Yeah,
but that sort of aesthetic is what perhaps why people are going back there. It's because the 2000s don't massively have. I mean, I've seen things done in the 2000s and not known when they were filmed, because I couldn't judge through the style.
Yeah.
So maybe that's why we're having to go back 30 years rather than 20.
Or maybe it's just 10. Us. Maybe we've just got to this age where it's difficult to distinguish looking back.
But when I was in the 90s, I could distinguish the 60s or the 50s.
Oh, yeah, yeah, sure,
or the 70s.
But you hadn't lived through them, had you?
Yeah, but even through the eras I have lived, the 90s and the 80s, I can distinguish. The 2000s...
No, maybe there's something to do with perception. When you reach a certain age and everything feels as if it's been done already, or feels familiar, there's a familiarity that's imbued into everything. That you don't get when you're 16, 20, 25.
Well, I have considered that.
Right, okay.
It sounds very egotistical to say, well, there hasn't been changes in the last 20 years, and they have to some degree. Again, I don't know whether this is to do with media changes.
Well, I think there must be something about the tangibility of the retro era as well. You can pick up things from the 1980s. You can't pick up music from 2010. You can listen to it. You might be able to go into a record shop if you can find a branch of HMV and find a CD of it, but it's a lot easier to pick up cassettes and CDs and LPs from the 80s, books and comics in specialist stores, than it is to get stuff from 10 years ago.
Could be.
It's on eBay for a start off.
I mean, could it also be that you have... ironically, broadcasting produced a sort of narrower width of data than the narrow casting we have now, which is done in such greater multitude that there are so many voices that, again, you don't get any dominant sort of fashion or styles or tones to start shifting things quite as fast.
I think I understand what you said.
Because back in the sort of 80s, 90s, well, back since television, let's go the 50s to the 2000s, you've got a very limited avenues of information. And if as soon as you get limited, you get limited amounts of vocabularies. And I'm talking vocabularies as in all sorts like fashion, tone, and thus genres or even eras become a lot more easily defined because you've got fewer things to define them. Well, now you've got thousands of things to define you, thousands of different voices, all of them accessible. And does that sort of not mean that nothing's changing, but nothing cohesively changes visibly because there's just so many things that are changing at the same time? So we are seeing, there are things changing, but we're just not really picking up on them because there's just too much information to disseminate them. I don't know. But it just certainly feels like, I mean, I was watching the Gilmore Girls. I started watching that, which was sort of 2000, 2001. Beyond, there was one guy with curtains back, you know, who was in Supernatural, and there was no mobile phones of any notice. To me, the actual state, it could have been 2008, 2009. You know, I look back at Babylon 5, feels very 90s in a lot of way. I look at Battlestar Galactica, that could still effectively be done now, bar, you know, the graphics perhaps being a little rougher than they would be now. But the actual styles in there, the actual content, doesn't feel massively different. You couldn't say it's a 2000s particularly. So, so it's just interesting at the moment, going back to Thor, that we're seeing this callback to the 80s, and I think it's because 80s has got this sort of style attached to it. And I think also, style, like you said, is technology, isn't it? So to some degree, how we, it's not just hair gel, neon socks, or sort of Bermuda shirts get to the 90s, or, you know, grunge looks. It's also things like tape decks, CD players. So I think you're right there. I think certainly because things have become more intangible, especially since 2008, 2009, you've got less visible things to mark your eras.
Yeah, I think that's what it is.
So I think that is a factor as well.
Yeah. In terms of movies, I think I would largely agree with you about any visual medium. It is difficult to distinguish exactly where it comes from in the past 20 years. Music, I don't go mainstream with music, so I don't really know what is a chart act, what isn't a chart act. I just listen to music that I like whenever it's been produced. So I might be listening to... For instance, I might be listening to some acoustic blues music one day on Amazon Music, or I might be listening to the Arctic Monkeys, for instance. You know, I could be listening to anyone. I could be pulling up a track by Tammy Wynette, or I could be pulling up a bit of blues music by a very, very good... female vocalist called Joanne Shaw Taylor. It doesn't matter to me.
But even with music, do you have the same issue there? That maybe, whether it's changed or not, you don't get that that dissemination of different types or different particular vogues because you don't have that sort of broadcasting situation. I mean, Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
As terrible as it was often, and the chart show, it was giving people, and there wasn't that many other things to watch, it was giving people a very clear identity of what was in, what sounds were popular, and people would buy into those sounds, and those sounds would be replicated because they were popular, as most genres, how genres work. But if you don't have that, and you have things like Spotify, which now sort of breaks things down into sort of narrow casting to your personal choice, do you end up not getting those sort of genre sort of shapes, which are then become subgenres, which become genres? Do you see what I mean?
So, well, Top of the Pops was, for many people, Top of the Pops was the most important program of the week, wasn't it? Because it gave them an idea of what they wanted to record on Sunday with a tape in the tape in the stereo with record and pause, or record and play and pause down, waiting for whoever was Peter Powell or Mark Goodyear or whoever, depending on your decade, was going to bring up the tune so you could press pause and record the song. And it didn't matter whether you were keeping it for yourself or you're giving it to someone else. You recorded those songs and you checked them out on Top of the Pops first, and you saw what the performances were like, you saw what the bands were like, you saw who the groups were. Now, you don't know who groups are now. They're largely faceless. And they're very, I mean, that might be a marketing thing, or maybe started out as a marketing thing, to have a kind of uniform feel, particularly within particular sort of like schools of production or whatever. But it really makes the whole thing very, very bland and very forgettable. In my opinion, Top of the Pops was one of the most important shows. If they can bring back Come Dancing as a game show, if they can bring back Doctor Who and various other shows that they can bring back, they can certainly bring back Top of the Pops.
But even if they did, it wouldn't capture that audience as it once did, because we've still got the narrow casting thing.
Yeah, well, there is that. I wouldn't argue with that, but, you know, that's the case across television, isn't it? So, you know, this, you know, we've got like a third of the viewers that we had on TV 30 years ago.
Yeah.
On the main channel, certainly.
But does that also, is there a change in how we actually, because now, if I go to, when I go to Spotify, I'll go and look for music that I want to listen to, rather than being given music.
Well, you're not going to see them, are you? You're going to get a feeling of who that group are through the music itself. But if that is like a great band who are clearly great professionals, that may not be a big problem. If this is like a manufactured group, you're not going to get much idea of who they are through the music. You're probably not going to care that much about them.
True. But then maybe that's the other thing, is that we do have, is Top of the Pops now, things like the X Factor, is that where it's a far more insidious sort of audience,
it's a very sort of brutal thing, isn't it? And I would say that probably, you're probably right, but that doesn't mean that has to be it.
No, it doesn't have to be singly, and it's a very slow process, because ultimately you're only there for them to market research the one band that's going to sell well for the singer. So yeah, I agree, and I think it would be great, and I would not be surprised if that came back. I am surprised it has not come back. The music industry has not pushed as well to have a sort of prime time music show like that, to sort of try and re-energize a sort of, you know, music into a very specific controllable risk management system, where you can sort of plug particular big bands and see what bands are working, what genres are working. And I don't know, it's all really interesting. Everything's changed. And I think the bottom line is that Thor Ragnarok, while it's very retro and while it doesn't do anything particularly new, indicates some of those changes that we're seeing at the moment, or how they're managing these changes. And again, I wonder with Star Wars, maybe one of the mistakes Star Wars is making is Marvel astute enough to know that arc sequel serialized movies are perhaps going a little out of fashion now, that people are tired of keeping up with them. Yeah. And they just want standalone ones, which might have links to others, but don't necessitate you having to go and see others. So you can just go in, enjoy without feeling the pressure of having to see another film after. And maybe Star Wars has just got into the sequel, back end of the sequel market, where people are just tired of sequels. They don't want to wait to see what's in the mystery box. And when they find out the mystery box is that Rey's parents aren't as interesting as they hoped, they're disappointed and annoyed. Yeah. They've been waiting to find out. And so maybe that is why Marvel, apart from Infinity War, is which was already planned, is stepping back and going, have fun, stand alone, all interconnected still. So they've got their nice little promos, little paratext to other movies that you might go and see on their range, but ultimately, you know, just enjoy this thing. So yeah, maybe Star Wars is the mistake. Maybe the way to go is Rogue One.
Yeah.
Solo, maybe.
Or just dropping the entire Skywalker era.
Well,
I'm not saying go to the Old Republic. I'm saying it was a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, so bring it a bit not so long ago.
Well, maybe The Force Awakens should have been more of an effort to bring the old cast in as a transition to the new cast, and then let the new lot just do a new thing, if you had to have that transition, because I think inevitably Star Wars fans would have expected it.
Yeah.
But did it have to be something which is now dragged on?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think taking it a different, like the video games did, but not by going into the past. Because I think that's because that's the only option they had, really. They could only go into the past rather than push the story into the future.
Or maybe the mistake again was assuming that we needed another trilogy.
Yeah.
You know, trilogies were a big thing back in the 80s. You know, that's how films sort of kind of work. They do a first, win a second, and then they were kind of aware they get to the third, they were winding down, the box offices wouldn't be so great. So if you get a trilogy, that's a nice run, beginning, middle, end.
Yeah.
And obviously, the quest for peace might be a mistake that would be pushed through by pure economics. But a three is a good number, but now maybe their mistake was not just doing standalone films in the Star Wars universe that could have dropped in and out old characters, but were more like Rogue One.
Yeah.
Or, you know, but set ahead of Return of the Jedi. So you'd have a story that would deal with Rey and Finn. And yes, you could have Han Solo appear, but it's not intrinsically, as you say, another Skywalker-led, Death Star-led. It could be anything. In your next movie, it could be a new set of characters, or maybe a couple of those and Luke Skywalker. A bit like the Clone Wars, where you had such an ensemble cast, each episode didn't necessarily have to be about Anakin Skywalker. You could even have ones where he wasn't there. And maybe that would have had the confidence to move forward and give you kids as well a new universe to explore. I don't know.
No, I think you're probably right. Well, there's certainly something in what you say. Let's go back to Ragnarok. There's some other interesting casting in there. There's Tessa Thompson as Valkyrie.
Yes.
Which, she was quite fun, I thought. She was a quite different character for a superhero movie.
I don't know Valkyrie very well from the comics, so...
No. Neither do I. There's a bit of a Han Solo thing going on with her, I think.
Yeah, she was good. I must admit, she's probably the one that I found least memorable.
Okay.
And I think that's just simply that nothing to do with...
There's a lot of big characters in there, isn't there?
There's a lot of big characters, and between all these big characters, there's not a horrendous amount for her to do, except play a little bit of resistance.
Yeah, there is a bit of... Which is why I think she's good, because there is a bit of the plot device about her character. But
yes.
there's more to it, whether that's her or there's a bit more in the writing or whatever, there is more to it than that, which I think is good. Carl Urban as Scourge. Now, he isn't in the movie very much at all, and yet he's kind of quite memorable.
Yes, I liked him in that. He plays like Tessa. He plays a bit of a sort of not a plot mechanic character is the wrong term for it. He's almost like a resistor character that is there to sort of generate resistance to where things are going in both the protagonist antagonist world. You could say Tessa is the resistor for Thor. You could almost say that Carl's character is the resistor for Cate Blanchett's, for Hela. And they sort of, so they don't do anything amazing, they don't do anything particularly mind-blowing, but they're there to create some form of tension that the audience can be aware of and see some resolution at the end. And Carl's is good. It's funny when I think of the Valkyrie character, you think of how epic her backstory is, but in this film it feels just almost like a side note. This massive epic battle that she has with Hela, and she's the last, and it's all, you know, these Valkyries and everything, and yet it almost feels like something you can forget in the scheme of the scale of this movie, which is kind of crazy. And so, who else have we got?
Obviously, we've got Ruffalo as Bruce Banner / Hulk, who's been the Hulk for a while, which is interesting because they did that in the comics, didn't they, for a time where he was trapped as the Hulk. Yeah.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, they did that, and they did the Planet Hulk thing.
Yeah.
I think it's kind of sad that Ruffalo sort of said he might stand down from Banner because he feels he's getting a bit old to play him. And I'm like...
That's an opportunity, isn't it?
Well, surely, yeah. I mean, comics keep people the same age purely because they can.
Yeah.
There's no actor. There's no age, really. Age is defined by the changes in the culture around the comic.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I remember... various characters ended up being part of Vietnam, and like I think Forge was in Vietnam, the X-Man character who had the rather ridiculous mutant power of inventing things. But now, if Forge is in the I wonder now, I don't know, I'm sure people could tell me whether Forgit still exists, and if he did, I can bet that he wasn't in Vietnam, because it would have made him horrendously old. With Mark Ruffalo, I think you're right, especially when you've got things like Old Logan in the comics, and you have older versions of these characters that have appeared. I think it makes it more interesting. You can explore things around that character. People like Ruffalo. They like him as Banner. He did. I don't want him to stop being Banner. I still don't want Logan to change, personally. I still think Hugh Jackman was great. But, yeah, I hope he carries on.
And the great Anthony Hopkins as Odin.
Yes.
He got a few outfits out of this, didn't he? He's only in it for about 5 minutes, and he's got like 3 costume changes or something.
Well, he was reluctant to come back, wasn't he, as far as I recall?
Although, God, after seeing him in Transformers 4, God knows why.
It's funny,
could have ruined
that,
his career, that movie. I know he's had his career, mostly. But what a terrible movie that is.
It always amazes me when you get actors who will sort of be very... It's like Harrison Ford, who loathes Han Solo but loves Indiana Jones. And to me, as I've said before, there's not a horrendous amount between the two.
No, not really.
James Bond sits somewhere in the middle, probably. And it's... But yeah, it's weird. But yeah, he came back for this, and I think he did a good job. It was nice to see him one more time. But I also thought it was very ballsy. I know they've done it in the comic, but destroying... Asgard was quite a surprise. I wasn't expecting that, even though it has happened. So I suppose people would argue it's not that ballsy if it's just following the comics. But so far, as creating an established universe for mainstream audiences, I think, and that having been stapled to the other two films.
Yeah. Well, of course...
It could reappear.
He could, but, well, who knows? Obviously, Cumberbatch is in there as Strange, as we've mentioned. And, of course, there is the other person who's in all the movies, which perhaps we should do a podcast on one day.
Well, Stan Lee.
Yeah. On all of his cameos.
Yes.
Because they're always entertaining.
Didn't he do a load of them in one bulk at one point recently?
He may have done. He may have done. They wouldn't surprise me. The one in Homecoming is particularly good, I think.
Which is when
Spider-Man stops that guy from stealing the car. But he's not stealing the car, he's breaking into his own car because he's lost his keys. Stanley sticks his head out the window and shouts, and there's a woman over the street there. Yeah.
Yes. That was good. Yeah. So, I mean, I know people get frustrated with all these superhero movies. I never thought... I mean, I went off them in the mid-2000s, I think, when Iron Man came up, and I was like, I just can't be bothered. I don't like Iron Man particularly. And Captain America, I never thought would work. For the same reason that I think DC thought Superman wouldn't.
Well, and I didn't think Captain America would work because they'd done it already, haven't they? And it was terrible.
In what?
The 1990s movie, yeah.
Yes, true. By that note, many superhero films have been done terribly. I mean, the Justice League had that terrible late 80s, early 90s one. And now it has a terrible 2010 one.
And then there's the Fantastic Four.
But Captain America, yeah, absolutely, which has been fairly consistently terrible. But Captain America is, I think, is interesting because he is the equivalent in a lot of ways to Superman. He is the national hero. He is the patriot. He stands for good values. And he's one which I think they played well, the way they did give him reasons to sort of sit culturally with us as an alien to our world, both in Civil War and even in his own time. But they didn't sort of change the character for it. While with Superman, it just felt like they weren't confident enough to do Superman like that. And I think that's where DC's got to step back and go, what are these characters actually about? How do I translate this to the big screen confidently without feeling like I'm scared that people won't understand this character anymore? So I think that's always the mistake. I think you've got to be very careful when you sort of modernize.
Yeah.
That they just lose what makes them interesting. I think DC's still got a massive catch-up to do. And so far, it's only been Wonder Woman, which is
it's pretty much one-way traffic with superhero movies, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. And obviously there are two or three more coming out this year.
Yes. So we've got Deadpool 2.
Yes.
And we've got Avengers Infinity War.
Yeah. Which is part one of two, isn't it?
I believe so. Which I think, I'm almost sure Marvel is regretting at the moment. I'm not sure what else they've got this year. We've obviously got Black Panther, which is out now.
Yeah. So there's three this year. So let's wrap that up then. In terms of the Marvel movies that we've had to date, and I think you can go with any of them, really. Where would you put Ragnarok?
I think it's pretty much my favourite, which I never thought a Thor movie would be, because my least favourite are the Thor movies. So he amazingly sits at both ends of the spectrum at the moment. I just really enjoyed it. I loved his comedy. I loved the action. I loved the soundtrack. I loved the vivid visuals.
The soundtrack is awesome. That was one of the things that got me thinking of A Flash, was very distinctive. It's completely different to Queen. It was very distinctive. Although there's a lot of keyboards in the Flash Gordon soundtrack, which was, if you were around in 1980, Queen didn't do keyboards before 1980. Every weird sound you heard in a Queen record before 1980 came out of Brian May's guitar. From 1980, they started using keyboards. And you can hear it in the music. But in Flash Gordon, it's very heavy. But the type of keyboards you've got in Thor Ragnarok, the synths and everything, it's awesome stuff. It's really, really good.
We should really mention Taika Waititi,
director.
Yeah. I mean, because he also plays in the film as well as one of the other less known characters, isn't it? I can't remember what the character's name is. The rock guy.
Oh yes, Mike. Is it Mike?
Yeah, and he's great in that as well. So he I have to say he did a fantastic job at realising that movie and giving it the comedy and fun. And yet at the same time, as like you say, there's a lot of emotional moments for the characters within it too. So it's a good breed of film.
Definitely. I can't disagree with anything James has said. I would definitely say Thor Ragnarok is my favourite Marvel movie. And, you know, there's a lot to choose from, and I've had a lot of fun. I particularly liked the Captain America movies, because I'm a bit of a sucker for sort of cartoon Nazis, I'm afraid. So they're good movies. But Thor Ragnarok. If you haven't seen it, get out and see it, or wait for the DVD to pop down your Amazon chute, or your streaming version through Google Play or iTunes or whatever. And let us know what you think. That's all from James and myself for this Beyond Casterbris. Until next time, it's goodbye.
This is a Beyond Casterbris podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbris.com.